Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fucking clauses? That was my attempt at a Christmas moniker for you people, but it doesn't really make sense. What the fucking bells? Doesn't matter. Welcome to the show. This is Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF, if you're just tuning in for your first time. As we head into another year, if everything goes well in the next couple of weeks, I think we'll all be heading into another year. Well, most of us. Well, let's not get grim. You know what I'm saying? I mean, as a world, the individuals come and go on any given day. You know what? I dug us into a hole right out of the gate, and I was trying to fill this with holiday cheer, and now I'm basically prophesizing some of you will not be alive in the new year. And I'm not saying any of you in particular. God damn it. Why can't I just get out of this now? Let's just start over, but not start over. Hey, how you doing? Happy holidays. I hope they're going well for you, and I'm looking forward to 2016. Did that seem honest? Look, what I meant to say is I hope everybody is having a pleasant and somewhat relaxing holiday, if that's possible. I am, because I'm on vacation. I am in my home state of Nuevo Mexico. I'm up in the Santa Fe area. I'll be heading to Albuquerque shortly. Go see my dad for a couple hours. Try and make it through that. I'm here with the lady. Sarah's on the couch. It's been good. It's been intimate already. It's only been a few days. You know, I imagine this has been talked about by other people. But, you know, when you're in a place where there's nowhere to hide and you can hear and smell things, just right over there, and you just have to be. Here's my point. I think that a big moment in a relationship probably has to be when both people eat the same thing that's bad, and it fucks them both up inside. So here you are in this situation where you're like, well, there's no second room. There's only one bathroom, and that stuff fucked me up too in my stomach. It's like we're gonna have to ride this out. Look. I'm telling you, man, intimacy is it's a big tent, all right, full with a full range of sounds and smells ranging from the beautiful to the grotesque. That is what love and relationship is about, engaging in all the sounds and smells of the person you're with. It's mostly me. I'm not going to throw her under the bus. I'm stinky and I make noises. I'm just putting that out there. All right? Merry Christmas. Did I say that? Merry Christmas. So I didn't even mention who's on the show today. Bob Forrest, musician and sober guy, rehab celebrity and coach and advisor. Might remember him from the Dr. Drew business. What was that? Celebrity Rehab. He was in the band Thelonious Monster. Did a few records, and a notorious L.A. character, primarily defined back in the day by his heroin use. His most recent album is Survival Songs, which I like a lot. I'd never really listened to Thelonious Monster, and I put a little research in. I did my homework, and it's just interesting. You know, I'd heard about them for years, and I'd heard about Bob for years, and I'd even seen him around at the secret meetings. And never talked to him, but this was a pretty amazing conversation. I know a lot of you got sort of hung up with the idea of, what's episode 666 going to be? What's that going to be, man? Are you going to interview Satan, dude? What's it going to be? 666, what is that? Well, this is episode 666. We didn't plan it out. We didn't use that context to deliver you some ironic or non-ironic relative guest to 666. So I'm going to bend this one into something that you sort of latent Satanists and people who are mystified by the triple number. I'm going to try to bend it into something for you. Like, for instance, quite honestly, on this planet and in this life, there's fewer things that can be honestly called demonic possession other than heroin. Heroin is as close as one can get, I think, to demonic possession, because it robs you of your will and it takes over your life and it destroys you from the inside and the outside, and it makes you do things that you would never do if you weren't under the spell and addiction to heroin. Heroin is the fucking devil. Now, anything can be a devil, you know, if you let it go too far. That's what them sins are all about. You know what I mean? Food. Food can do a number on you. Power, lust, envy, you know, seven deadlies, sloth. Those things get too far with you. That's the work of the devil there. But heroin, because it was so romanticized by so many people, is no doubt the devil, or definitely a franchise. Heroin is a franchise of Satan, if there is a Satan, if that's your thing. If you depends how you look at it, where your mystical parameters are, what those are. But Bob Forrest is a great example of somebody who fought that fucking devil, came out the other side with an amazing amount of self-awareness and creative energy, and also helps a tremendous amount of other people. See, you know, you fight with the fucking devil, and then maybe you come out with some good stories and a little bit of wisdom, and he's one of those cats. And I was excited to talk to him. And obviously we had a conversation that had a lot to do with that. And those of you who are out there on the holiday, I've been getting a lot of emails from people struggling with addiction, alcoholism, people wondering whether or not they're an alcoholic. Generally, from where I'm sitting, in my experience, if you're asking other people if you might be an alcoholic, I would say you're probably an alcoholic. If it comes into your head where, like, you're sitting there, you know, and you've just shit your bed or something, and you're like, oh, I wonder if I have a drinking problem. No, you probably do, I would say. A couple of red flags. Peeing in your sleep, in your bed, shitting your bed, those are big red flags. Losing everything. Sitting in a room alone, weeping, wondering where your life went, but still saying, like, oh, I need a drink. That might be bad. If a lot of people tell you you might have a drinking problem, that's not easy for other people to say. And it's not, I don't think it's said lightly usually. So you know who you are, and I hope you take care of that. There's things you can do. There's places you can call. I know there are some people that say, and this is an important holiday message, depression too, get help. There's help out there. And I'm not going to tell you what help to get. You know, it's each to their own. If you think something's going to work for you, try it. Just get off the shit. Get the devil out of you if you can, by any means necessary. Just do it for a few days. See how you feel. You'll spin around. You'll freak out. But you get through it. People are built to adapt. And let's do a couple of corrections and then get on with it. I have a couple of corrections. On the Brian Grazer episode, apparently a lot of people, rightfully so, but folks, it's not so much that I'm getting old, but, you know, I have brain farts and problems, and, you know, I use the wrong word. I'm not Norm Crosby level. It's not my act, but I'll fucking... I used the wrong word. Like, apparently in the Brian Grazer episode, I used the word deliberate power, which I don't even know if it really makes any sense, as opposed to delegate. I've made note of that, and I've rewired my brain to not use that word inappropriately anymore. It's not inappropriately, wrong. It wasn't inappropriate, it just was the wrong word. In my conversation with Horatio Sanz, apparently we were both talking about different movies. He was talking about Crank, and I was talking about Crank 2. And we never really got resolution around that. That I was literally telling him he was wrong, but he was right and I was right. They were just different movies. I couldn't imagine, I guess, that they would, you know, make a second one. So I thought I was seeing the only one, though it was pretty compelling. The other thing I'd like to direct you towards, and I'm, you know, look, I'm not that self-serving or self-promoting, really. I do a podcast, but, you know, it's usually some sort of fucked up internal wrestling match. But a guy by the name of James Parker wrote a piece on me and my show, this show, for The Atlantic. The title of the piece is Mark Maron's Brilliant Mistakes. The star podcaster's success is rooted in his early career failure and despair. Of course, I'm going to read stuff about me. But look, I'll tell you this. I don't Google search my name. Look, I'm not trying to appear humble or like I have humility. I just don't have a Google search on my name. And I don't do that shit. I wait till it gets to me some other way. So somebody sent me the link to this on Twitter the other day. And this is a well-written piece. It's like it's got a point. It's got a context. A historical and stuff. I know it's about me, but I'm just saying that there are people that write criticism out there that are thoughtful writers. And I'll take shit, and I don't mind being characterized badly in a piece if there's a point to it. And this guy, though it's, you know, a very a nice piece about me, the way he describes me, I think if it was in another context or even if I was reading this wrong, I would be like, why is he saying that about me? Like, am I really that guy? But you know what? I am the guy that he depicted here, and I learned some things about myself and about the show because I don't think the way somebody outside of me thinks. And this guy wrote a very thoughtful, eloquent, pointed piece of criticism. See, a lot of people don't fucking understand in this culture, you know, what real criticism is and that there's a context and there's cultural relevance to it. But in order to keep their job, they write clickbait bullshit. They write, you know, snarky reviews. There's a definite difference between a review and a piece of criticism. And real critics are real writers. Reviewers are generally any asshole. And clickbait is cancer. Merry Christmas. Did I mention Merry Christmas? I want to make sure that's clear. Hope you're having a good holiday. And be careful, will you, this holiday season? Don't hurt yourself in one way or another. Emotionally, physically, don't hurt other people. Try. All right, just try. Try. Oh, wait. I just remembered something. Before I forget, again, to promote my own thing, Maron Season 3, my IFC show, will be on Netflix starting December 28th. That's a little uplifting stuff you can have between Christmas and New Year's. You can binge watch Maron Season 3. I know some of you are waiting to get caught up. Gets a little intense. Gets a little heavy this season. But enjoy Maron Season 3. Again, on Netflix, starting December 28th. All right, so that's, I did it. I promoted myself. I can do it. I can do it. Right now, we're going to go to my conversation with Bob Forrest. As I said, his new album is a folk album, actually, called Survival Songs, and he is going to play a couple after our chat. It's available now. Happy holidays. I'll talk to you after Bob.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
I picked up the new record today, the Survival Songs.
Yeah.
It's fucking great, man. I got it yesterday, and I just started, you know, I just listened to it real close. And, like, I'm not a big lyrics guy, and I'm not necessarily, you know, I don't know how much new folk music I listen to, or whether you'd call it that.
Not but the Van der Barnhart, you're not playing that stuff?
No, man. But it really resonated with me. It seemed real honest, and some of the songs are just, they're just fucking great, man.
Well, thank you.
Do you look at this new record as like one of your best?
I just wanted it to be in people's faces. I think that America's lost its storytelling. And my dad used to tell stories, and
yeah,
you didn't know if half of them were true or half of what he was telling you was true. But
didn't matter,
something
really
about storytelling that yeah, that like Studs Terkel and Gore Vidal and all these people, they used to just tell stories.
Yeah.
And it's not around anymore. And
we
I
don't have time. We don't have time, Bob. No time for stories.
Well, stories teach us.
We're going to have to wait till the end of this story?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was very compelling. So that's where it came from, is that you were writing. But it seemed like most of those things, I talked to a lot of songwriters in here, where, you know, and I always assume that everybody's writing from a first-person point of view. Those seem pretty personal to me.
They're personal.
Right.
They're my perspective of my life.
So storytelling was the inspiration.
Well, it always has been. I wanted to be a poet in college, and it didn't go, you know, poetry wasn't too popular.
Tough record. Yeah, that's really turned around. Boy, you missed a real opportunity there, Bob. You should have stuck with that.
I should have stuck with it, because I was up in San Francisco. They're going for it like crazy up there now.
Well, where'd you grow up?
Here in L.A. In,
really?
In Palm Desert, yeah.
Palm Desert.
Yeah.
Out there.
Out in the desert, just like you.
Desert guy.
Yeah.
Not like that desert. Albuquerque may be desert, but it sort of passes as a city. I mean, Palm Desert's kind of desert.
There's nothing.
But that's, how far is that from Desert Hot Springs?
It's like 20, 30 miles.
It's fucking nuts out there. So how the hell did you end out there? Was your dad in the military?
I was an illegitimate child, and so my parents wanted to hide me.
What?
Yeah, I was my sister's son.
Really? So your sister's how much older than you?
15 years.
So they just...
We had a vacation house down there, and I guess they just... Well, here's this forest story is, my dad had three daughters, and his middle daughter got pregnant at 14, and so they put her in St. Anne's Home for Unwed Mothers here in Silver Lake.
Really?
Yeah, Catholics. And my dad apparently said, because he's my dad, he's who raised me, he said, if it's a boy, we'll adopt it. If it's a girl, it goes up to Catholic Charities.
Right.
That's old school. And he wanted a son, and he got one, and he spoiled me, and he was the greatest. But
so you were, so do you know who your father is?
I knew his name, but...
You never...
I've tried to track him down two or three times, and he doesn't want any contact.
So your sister's your mom?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the way...
Like,
the way
not in Chinatown
right,
type way, not
right,
like
no,
incest.
No. Right.
But in a rock and roll-y Elvis Presley way.
Sure, I get it.
Because she told me when she was, she didn't really know about sex, but her boyfriend had a 45 player in the glove compartment of his truck.
Right.
And so they'd park and pull that thing out, put Elvis and Jerry Lee on.
They had a slide in the dash 45 player?
Yeah, it came out of the glove box, and the 45 player was just sitting there.
So he rigged it up.
He rigged it up.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how he seduced her?
Yeah.
But I guess so, because that was, how much older are you than me? What, that was in the
61.
Early 60s. So it was the early 60s, just coming out of the 50s. What she did was pretty bad news.
Yeah.
For the family and culturally.
Well, what happened was my family, you know, thought of themselves as some Los Angeles family. So they had a vacation house. So they just decided, you know, my mom who raised me and my three sisters and I would live in the desert house until I was like five. And then I would come back and everybody would just not notice, I guess.
So that was the plan? They did
that?
They sort of...
I came back for kindergarten.
And this was your dad's idea?
Yeah.
That, like, we just had this other kid?
Yeah, we just, you know, late in life, Jesus Christ.
You know, we were on the rhythm method. We didn't know what happened.
Yeah.
What was your dad's business?
A thrifty mart, supermarkets.
He owned them?
No, he built them.
Oh, he's a contractor?
And they were famous here in L.A. because they had big T signs.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great things. And he died when I was 15, but... One of the great things that was touching for me is in Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays, mm-hmm. which is one of the greatest novels written about L.A., when she's going to get her abortion...
What's it called?
Play It As It Lays by Joan Didion.
Okay.
When she's going to get an abortion, the character or whatever, they say, get on the Hollywood freeway and go north and get off as soon as you see the big red T. That's my dad's signs.
Yeah.
They're these 40-foot tall neon signs.
All gone.
Yeah, they're all gone.
Wow.
It's smart and final now.
not as exciting.
No.
All right, so you're out in the desert with your sisters and your mom. Your dad's in town building shit. And what are you doing out there? Well, how many, I can't, I can pick, is that's not 29 Palms. Palm Desert,
Palm Desert is, it's, you know, well, years later when I went to Joshua Tree, it's very much like Joshua Tree.
Right.
It was very rural. There was nothing, just desert and date trees. And we rode motorcycles and, you know, so caught lizards. And
you thought you had a pretty good childhood?
It was great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you had some friends? Were you, because I know Josh Ami comes from Desert Hot Springs?
Yeah, they're around those guys are much younger.
No, I know.
It was a city by the time they were born.
Yeah, but it was crazy out there. There's still something about desert rats and desert life.
Desert people.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I have a house out in Pioneertown. There's desert people. They just, they're
their
own breed.
It's a weird mixture of like drifters and eccentrics and meth heads.
Yeah, antisocial, but idealists.
And they build shit out there.
Yeah, they build art.
Big ideas.
Yeah. There's guys out there, they build these huge art like installations with the intention of nobody seeing them.
Like out of bottles. That kind of shit.
Yeah.
It's wild, man.
They did got you ever something
go,
to say.
Did you go over? Did you ever go over to that Integratron thing?
Yeah.
What's the story?
I was living in
that?
A cave, and he was kind of thought he was talking to aliens. I think.
Right. It was. He was trying to start some sort of commune.
Yeah.
Thing,
yeah.
And
everybody was back then.
Yeah.
Hell yeah! I want to start one now.
And you kind of have one, don't you?
I want to start one.
You have a recovery commune.
Oh, the super secret society.
Yeah, that's what I like to call it, secret society meetings. Yeah. We're not so secret on this show. I don't use the name. I don't utter the name.
It's always been a problem for me.
I mean, it must be tricky. I mean, it's weird. I often wonder because I missed a lot of that generation of music that you come from with Thelonious Monster and Bicycle Thief and some of that LA music. I didn't get into it until later because I wasn't out here and I was really mainstream oriented. But I was wondering before you came over.
Well, what'd you like Steely Dan? Or
no,
what?
Fuck no.
I love Steely Dan.
I'm not a Steely Dan. You picked the one band.
Drink scotch whiskey all night long.
No, I get it.
Die behind the wheel.
I get it. Yeah, but it's a little too. I don't feel like that guy's dying and he hasn't. They're not. Not enough menace in those tunes, bro. I mean, I can understand.
Something about it that it's so slick and jazzy cool, and the lyrics are so depressing and suicidal and drug-induced.
Look, I have the records. I try every so often to engage, and it's not unlike me to. I do engage.
So you like Skinner?
Of course, sure.
I love Skinner.
I had all the records.
Me too.
I was, I liked the Stones. And like early on with in the late 70s, I got a box of records with some shit in it from the record store next door to where I worked as a high school kid. They were like R&B focused, and they had this big box of rock records they gave me. Like, they had Elvis Costello's first record there. And what else? I think
Sometimes
a Talking Heads.
Sometimes I wish that I could stop you from talking when I hear them silly things that you say.
Right?
That
album was a gut puncher.
Really was.
But other than that, fairly standard towny fare. I had some inspiration. There was
Fog Hat?
A little bit of Fog Hat, a little before my time, but certainly on the radio. Had all the Skinner records. Had a few Dead records. Had the Stones records. Had the Beatles records. A lot of Bowie. Pretty important to me. And then there was a guy at that record store who was an art rock dude. Turned me on to the Residents. Turned me on to Fred Frith, Brian Eno.
My five-year-old's favorite song is Constantinople.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he calls them the Eyeball People.
Yeah.
His name is Elvis after Elvis Costello.
Oh, after that Elvis. Good.
Yeah.
You make a differentiation.
Oh, he's five and he tells people, after Elvis Presley, he says, no, Elvis Costello.
Yeah. He was sitting right there last week, Elvis Costello.
Yeah, he's got the book out.
Yeah, a lot of, yeah, so that was sort of where I came from. If it weren't for that guy that turned me on to the Residents and that stuff, I don't know if my mind ever would have been blown.
Was it Bow Wow Records?
No, Bow Wow Records came much later.
We used to play there.
Sure.
We used to play
with
there.
With the Dalmatian spots on it.
Yeah.
Up on Central.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy was sort of kind of dickish, but he was all right.
He let you play there.
Yeah. No, back when I was a kid, it was Natural Sound next to the General Store, which was a head shop
over by the university. And it was all wooden across the street from the university.
That's right. I remember that place. Yep, yep.
Because I started touring in 83, roadieing for the Chili Peppers.
Was that their first album?
Yeah,
what was it? Up with Mofo Party Plan? Or?
Yeah.
Holy
no, no,
shit.
No. The first one was called Red Hot Chili Peppers. It was only like 28 minutes long or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And that was with, who was guitar playing? Was it Israel?
Well, no, Hillel never made the first record. He came back. They got a guitar player named Jack Sherman. He played on that record and that tour.
Mm-hmm.
But he just didn't fit. Right?
No, when the wrong kind
He's
of playing.
Kind of a teetotaler. Oh.
So how do you get from, so Palm Desert, did they make you go to Catholic school?
Oh, of course.
So you're real shit, you real fucking dyed in the wool Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
Like
I'm a God-fearing atheist.
Yeah, but still God-fearing. I don't believe in him, but just in case, yeah, it hedges my
I'm
bet.
In a world of shit.
You're making up for it, man.
I am trying to break even, what I always say.
But you brought up with a real fear of hell.
Oh, yeah, for sure. If you masturbate or
really?
All that kind of stuff.
So
yeah,
you were,
yeah.
And you went to confession and you had a priest.
Oh, yeah.
Catholicism sort of fascinates me. I mean, in retrospect, what are your feelings about it? The mind fuck of it.
It's changed a lot, but it was like, to me, it was like child cruelty. You know,
right?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I tell you, the funniest thing that ever happened, I was an altar boy, right? And my job was to hold the tray in case the host might fall out of the mouth of right. one of my students.
Coughing up the body of Christ.
Because we had mass every morning, yeah. right? So I'm 13, 12, maybe 12. And the girls always went on one side and the boys on the other side of the church. They kept them all separate, right?
Yeah.
But in the same room,
yeah,
of course. And so I'm doing the tray, and I remember, like it was yesterday, all of a sudden looking at these girls like yeah. that.
Yeah, with their mouth open.
And me holding the tray, I got a hard on.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and the priest knew it, too. And it was just like, holy shit, this yeah. is the greatest job ever.
The priest knew it. Of course he knew
oh,
it.
Oh, he knew it.
And so... So you went to Catholic school, and all your sisters, any of them turn out to be nuns, any of them?
No.
No?
Any of them? My sister-mom's been married like 5 times.
Your sister-mom?
Yeah.
Has been married 5 times.
It's like a Mormon thing. Yeah, like yeah. sister-mom.
What about the other sisters?
My one younger sister, the younger of the three, yeah. died from Lou Gehrig's disease a few years ago. So just crushing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
How long did that go on for?
Like 3 years. It's
and
horrible.
How old was she?
She was only in her... early 50s.
And that's
50s.
When it came on, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, when I first, you know, we were trying to find out what it is, and I was standing in the nurse's station at yeah. our rehab years ago, and I wrote this, you know, the long-term thing, and Dr. Drew was standing over to my right, and he looked down, and he goes, "Who has that?" And I said, "My sister." And he goes, "Oh, fuck." And I was like, "What is it?" And he goes, "It's known as Lou Gehrig's disease."
And
so, you know you're going to get sick. That's the torture of it.
And it's one of those ones where you lose complete muscular control.
Eventually, you're just inside your body and it's not working.
Oh, my God.
How fucked up is that?
And you were sober and there for it, right?
I was trying.
Where was she?
In Huntington Beach.
Oh, she was close.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were trying? What, they wouldn't let you?
Well, I was like the black sheep of the family. My brother-in-laws have never really quite taken to me.
Oh, yeah.
And plus, I know now, because I've been married a few times, too. And that thing with girls and their brothers,
yeah.
I don't understand it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, what is it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
What the...
They just love their brothers, no matter how big of fuck-ups they are. And I
yeah.
was a fuck-up for decades.
But the husbands didn't go for it.
Oh, they were not. And just couldn't seem to, no matter how long I stayed sober or did the right thing, it was just...
Didn't matter.
Were
they stiffs? Were they... what do you call
They're
it?
Like Republicans, if that's what you mean.
Sure. I was trying to use an old term that sort of covers a lot.
I grew up in Republican land, and
yeah.
I've been a liberal or whatever you call it. What do you call it these days? Progressive? Or,
sure, whatever you want. Progressive, you know, liberal,
lefty. Used to be a
commie.
I liked when they called us commies.
Yeah.
So,
that's a little specific now.
You
got to broaden it out. It's Big Ten.
Progressive.
Yeah, sure. Progressive's
progressive
good.
In thought.
Yeah.
So I remember I was watching, you know, my dad was watching the news, and it was the Vietnam War, and I was like 8 or 7.
Yeah.
And I went up to the TV, and it was right when they were starting to show when Cronkite wanted to show the blood of the war.
Yeah.
Right? And so I said to my dad, "That's not real blood, is it?" And he said, "Bobby, get out of here. It's none of your goddamn business." And I was like, the real kids are getting killed? This is fucked up. At 7 or 8, I knew it was wrong. Now I'm 54. I know it's wrong.
Right.
When,
yeah.
You know, when
we feel it.
It's strange, though, how obsessed and kind of, you know, this obsessed with war, the world is, yeah. and particularly the American perspective of war.
Well, after that war, American got, you know, pretty cynical about it once they sort of started to see the truth of it and the confusing
you needed a better
agenda.
Enemy. You needed a better enemy. Now we've got the greatest enemy of all.
Yeah, ourselves. Well, but was your dad that guy? Was he a monster?
No, he was a fun guy. He was a larger than life guy, that kind
stories.
Of post-war mm-hmm. guy. Golfer, hunter, fun Dodger games.
Did you learn how to play golf?
Yeah, oh yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah?
Well, what the fuck are you going to do out there? I've been golfing since I was like 3.
Do you golf now?
No, I can't do it. What happened was I played in high school and college. And then, of course, you know, I found all kinds of other things, more interesting things. Not drugs predominantly, but girls.
Yeah.
You know. And
fuck golf.
Yeah,
golf wasn't too cool, I guess.
Golf is not going to get you too popular.
Well, I guess at the time you were growing up, which is a little ahead of me, I mean, there were two paths. Do you know what I mean? If you're going to choose the golf path, it's going to be, it's not as cool a slog, and the chicks are certainly different than the rock and roll path.
Yeah, the rock and roll thing. Well, it was really Lenny Bruce. There's the book. I read it when I was 13 years old.
Goldman's
book.
Yeah.
I read that. I went and saw Lenny at the movies. Did that come out in 74?
That sounds about right.
I was 13. I went and saw it, and I was just became obsessed with him. I always
Lenny
have
Bruce.
Been, yeah.
So wait, so you go, you play, you go to high school, you do the Catholic thing. Where do you go to college?
I go to college lots of different places, like for years and years.
Yeah.
LACC, Golden West College in Huntington Beach. I faked my way into Cornell for a semester.
How'd you do that?
Because it was before computers. And I got financial. I got.
Isn't that in upstate New York?
Yeah, yeah. I had an aunt that lived up there. I had to get out of L.A. The black beauties were killing me.
Speed. I remember those.
Open them up and snort them.
Yeah. And those yellow jackets.
Everybody talks about those. I don't know what those are. They had black beauties here.
Yeah, black
and you could
beauties
open
and
them up and
jackets,
snort them.
And the white crosses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember snorting yellow
I
jackets.
I want to hear an interesting story about the Super Secret Society.
Yeah.
When I was a senior in high school, I used to drink Bacardi and Coke in class, you know.
Yeah.
I lived on my own. I
in
lived in my
gulp?
Own apartment. Yeah, in a Del Taco cup. And so my teacher, my English teacher, who I really liked, said, could I talk to you after school, Bobby? And I was like, oh, okay. So I came and, you know, and she said, do you think you have a drinking problem? And I was like, no. And she goes, would you be interested? Because I used to have a drinking problem and I don't drink anymore. Would you want to come and meet some people that I, like, I forget how she phrased it.
Right.
And she was a lesbian. So I knew. She's asking me to go somewhere with her.
Yeah.
I didn't really know what lesbians were, but I wanted to go where lesbians were.
Sure.
So I went with her. It was a 12-step meeting in Laguna Beach.
Yeah.
Chuck C was probably there.
Yeah.
I remember, I was 17. I remember thinking, oh, this is good for old people.
Right. I'm just starting drinking. I don't know how these people got here. They must misunderstand it.
I like the stories, and I like that old people got together and didn't drink.
That's another interesting thing that you bring up, stories, because the narrative of an AA pitch is at times the most moving thing.
It really is.
Like, it kills me every time. Like, I think it taught me how to feel properly.
Me too.
You too?
Yeah.
Because, like, I find, you know, that...
An identification.
Sure.
Identify.
You get it? And then that moment where AA reaches out or they find it, and you start... I start to get weepy, man.
I do.
It's like there's natural turn where this life is saved, life is changed. So that story thing is really it's really cathartic.
But now, you know, Southern California has been perverted by rehabs. There's 3,000 rehabs around here. So the 12-step thing gets, nowadays, those stories now become the solution. I'm going to tell you how to do it.
Right.
You know, which is a real problem for me. I'll ask somebody I like to tell me how to do it.
Right.
I don't need your opinion
of
how to do it.
Let me find somebody who has what I want.
And identify with.
Right.
And so it's become so solution-oriented and telling people to do the steps and do that.
That's the sort of thing about...
Rehab's AA for profit. So, you know...
Well, I mean, this is an interesting point of view for someone that helped commercialize it in a way, you know, publicly and media wise.
And I will pay for that after I'm gone.
You feel that?
Yeah,
out of all
no.
the things, that's what you're going to go to hell for? Celebrity rehab. That's right. You're going to die and get to the gate.
They're going to go, you put celebrities on television suffering from a disease of alcoholism? And I was like, yep.
How many seasons?
Five.
No, you're going to hell.
No, for sure.
Everything else you did, we can forgive you for.
Stealing money out of my mom's purse.
No problem.
No problem.
Exploiting sick celebrities.
One of the worst thing I ever did,
mm-hmm.
I used to steal from a friend of mine that lived in Los Feliz because I felt that he had a lot of things and
yeah.
I didn't have any.
Yeah,
you know that rationalization?
Sure, sure.
So when Laserdisc first came out, he had a bunch of them,
yeah.
right? And they were very valuable, if you remember.
Sure.
Like,
because no one
bucks.
Had the machines. It was like a very rare thing.
Yeah, very elite thing.
Yeah.
So I'd grab like, you know, three or four and put them by the front door and take them and go sell them and get dope. And one time I was selling them.
Yeah.
And it was The Lion King. He had like a 7-year-old daughter. And I was like,
you had a 7-year-old?
No, he did.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, and they were going through it at Rockaway over there in Silver Lake. They were yeah. like, I go, oh, no, I don't want to sell that one. Because yeah. I knew it was his daughter's. Yeah. And I was like, going to sneak
bad.
It back in or
yeah.
something. And he says, Disney is $20. I said, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And in the okay, the rationalization of the junkie is, I'm going to sell it right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back right. when things are, you know.
Right,
when
sure.
You
buy
know,
it back.
Yeah, and buy it back and sneak it back in.
But right now, that's two bags, right?
Yeah. So the fact was, you know, just it was the worst thing I ever did.
And you're fucking nodding off and there's some 7-year-old girl crying, where's the Lion King? And you're like in a downtown going, sorry, kid. Priorities.
Yeah. Priorities.
So, all right. So you're drinking at 17, but like when you're, how long did you fake at Cornell?
Just like 4 months till they caught me. Well, what the thing was, I got both Social Security because my dad had died, and I got financial aid.
How'd he die?
He died of suicide, actually. Yeah.
Was he sick?
Yeah, he was sick.
Oh, so it was like he took himself out?
Yeah, he had one of the first open heart surgeries in California.
Uh-huh.
He didn't like it. Made you an invalid back then. You like literally went from...
Because you're all purple and you
circulate. He just couldn't golf. He couldn't do much. He couldn't eat the way he wanted. He couldn't smoke. He couldn't drink.
Ugh.
And he just felt like his life was over. Then his best friend shot himself.
Before he killed himself.
Yeah, a couple weeks before.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was a
And you knew that guy too?
Yeah, Curly Einboden, one of the greatest guys ever, my dad's best friend.
Why'd he kill himself?
Because he was having health issues too.
Really?
Yeah, and it's still going on.
Too proud to go through
you
it.
You can drink and drug yourself crazy if you know what you're doing, let's
yeah.
say. But you hit mid-50s, late-50s, you're gonna implode.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And I've watched my friends in this generation, I'm 54, I've watched the people that didn't go to rehab or get sober because they just drink or they do dope on the
right.
weekends or
right.
whatever, or do some coke and then they put coke behind them. They just physically implode right around now.
Really? Yeah, because, yeah.
That's... Liver can't take it, body,
right.
heart can't take it.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
You want it to last longer?
Well, no, because like I've got 16 years. So I stopped when I was like, 35 or
35,
something.
Me too, 35.
And I'd gotten enough in, but I didn't go as hard as you. But like, there have been
you
guys.
You know the price of dope.
Uh-uh.
$10.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I knew that.
That's the guy that knows.
That was not my thing.
No?
No.
How'd you know it was $10?
Well, I tried it a couple times. But it didn't stick. I was lucky.
Really? Did you like it?
No, I like going up, and I never was a needle guy, so it was all coke and weed and drinking for me.
And what town
sometimes.
Was it mostly going on, here or in New York?
It was mostly, I guess it would have been mostly in New York. I started in college, a lot of coke, and then when I got out here, I got fucked up on coke, and I got psychotic, and I had to leave. I was here for a year at the Comedy Store, hanging out with Kennison. I lost my mind from coke and sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
And then I cleaned up the first time, went back to Boston where I went to school and sort of started over. I'd get a year and a half here, a year and a half there, never locked into the program, and I'd always pick up with the coke and booze again.
Coke, but, really?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It was always my thing. And I never knew enough about drug guys to get fucking downers. Like, I was always the guy up all night next to a sleeping chick who was just, like, not on coke, thinking I was going to die. Never had a goddamn Valium connection. Never got into dope to come down. I imagine if somebody had said, like, this dope, if you snort this, it'll take you back down. It would have been a different life for me, or it might have been over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about coke, I had a lot of friends that were on coke. Just like it calmed hyper people down.
Sort of what I did to me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'd kind of lock in to a weird kind of peaceful confidence.
Yeah, peaceful. Yeah, and it makes me agitated. I need heroin. But I do that all the time.
So, all right. So you go to Cornell for 4 months. And then you come back, and your dad commits suicide. But that was when you were 15. Yeah. So we're jumping around. But I guess I'm trying to focus in on
where the torture comes from.
Well, no, where does it start? Where did you get turned on to Lenny Bruce? What were you doing that sort of threw the switch?
Well, I was a lonely, kind of isolated kid, right? Yeah. So the desert, when you grow up in the desert, there's nobody, you know, nobody around. It's just a bunch of retired people, really.
Yeah.
And so really my room was always my sanctuary. That's where I listened to Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, or the Beach Boys. I loved the Beach Boys.
Did you?
Loved them. And so I'd listen to the Beach Boys. To me, the Beach Boys are always sad music.
No, he makes me terribly sad.
It's sad.
Yeah.
People think it's so happy.
When I listen to Pet Sounds, it's like almost unbearable. It's like listening to Daniel Johnston music. Like,
it was really something.
Yeah, it was just like, I just hear this fucking weird, almost like bottomless pain.
I had a funny thing where he Bob Dylan played the Greek Theater. And I was walking in that guest thing, this in the late 80s or something. Uh-huh. And I happened to be right behind Brian Wilson and his Dr. Eugene Landy.
Yeah,
and they
were
walking in that backstage area.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Dylan was standing there. And I just happened to be like 3 feet away from Bob Dylan. Just, I'd seen Bob Dylan play. And then I was just had a backstage pass or whatever.
Right.
Brian Wilson comes up and Bob Dylan goes, "Hey, Brian." And Brian Wilson's like looking confused, and he goes, it's Bob. And Brian Wilson's like, and Bob Dylan explains how they know each other.
Really?
It was the weirdest thing.
Oh, and
I think
sad.
When you watch the movie that came out,
I think that
Eugene Landy had him so doped up on medicine. I don't think that's really,
right.
He was that disconnected from reality. It was medicine, probably. You know, Thorazine and all kinds of crazy
psychics.
So Bob
had to explain who he was?
Who he was and how they knew each other. And I was just sitting there like privy to this really weird rock and roll moment.
Yeah.
And that doctor right next to him.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So you're out in the desert, you're listening to Ziggy's.
Yep.
And where's Lenny come in?
Lenny came in because I saw the movie. I loved movies. Movies is what you could do. You could go see the world right down at the Palm
and they were
Desert
playing
Twin.
Lenny.
Yeah.
Bob Fosse's Lenny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, who the fuck is this guy?
I saw Chinatown Lenny, Godfather 2. That was the greatest era of movies.
I just watched both Godfathers back to back. Great.
Dude, Michael Corleone, baby.
Great, man. I mean, just those... You know, two generations of method guys acting the fuck out of that movie.
Going right at it.
I know. Oh, it's crazy.
It's really something. So I saw Lenny, and I just, that whole world, it was kind of like the books I was reading at the time, like On the
Beatnik
Road.
Shit.
And,
yeah.
So then I got that book, that Albert Goldman book, and it was literally my Bible. Like when I used to tour in Thelonious Monster, I toured like how Lenny Bruce did, with a briefcase full of magazines and books. Cassettes, Ghetto Blaster, tinfoil up the windows.
Really?
Yeah. Every
you
hotel.
Learned it there? You learned
yeah,
it from Lenny?
That's what he would do.
That was your model.
Like, well, everybody, rock and roll is very, it's a very kind of imitating thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And what's funny is so many people imitating, you know, Keith Richards and David Bowie.
Right.
You know, David Bowie in his cocaine era when he's so thin or whatever.
Oh, yeah, with Young Americans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it's like it feeds off itself. Nowadays, kids are doing it like they think John Frusciante did it.
Yeah, I've seen him look pretty bad sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he was there. He was out there as far as you can go.
I got a record that came out not too long ago, and I did not get what he was doing.
Oh, the techno stuff?
Yeah, and maybe just the last record. What's the last record?
Yeah, it's called Venetian Snares. It's all techno. Yeah,
yeah,
it's not my cup of tea,
let's
say.
Where is this at, man? Where is he at?
He's at, I know exactly where he's at.
Well, you got your buddies, right?
He doesn't want to have to, you know, rock gets so big.
Yeah.
And it's just like theater. You have to stand in this place.
Right.
Because the lights are programmed. You got to play this song that way.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And he's just not that type of guy.
But he's a hell of a guitar player.
Oh, he's the best.
And when he played with the Chili Peppers, you guys go way back, right?
Way back till when John was 16. He was in Thelonious Monster.
For a minute.
Yeah. And then the Chili Peppers saw him play.
So you're getting into Lenny Bruce. When do you first find drugs in Palm Desert? How the fuck does that happen?
Well, alcohol.
Right.
We used to break into vacation houses. You know
nice.
What I mean?
Yeah.
It was great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it was like the river's, not the river's edge, Over the Edge. Remember that Matt Dillon movie?
Oh, yeah.
That's what my life was like.
Right.
We like, you know, we would steal golf carts because the people would just park their golf carts in the breezeways, they were called.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have garages. They had breezeways.
Uh-huh.
They just plug them in. We just unplug them and go drive around with them.
But the cops must have known you.
Well, yes. Bobby Forrest, Tommy Paletti, David Vaughn, Scott Sims. One of my gang was the principal's son, Scott Sims.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were like a gang of hoodlums. And we started really getting more and more daring, like when we were like 14, 15. And it was in the newspaper, this vandalism stuff. And one of them brought it to school. They're like, dude, we're going to get caught. And I go, where'd you get that? Because I was the tough guy of the group.
Right, yeah.
I was like, dude, don't fucking say a word. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, I was holding our gang together.
Right.
Like, don't crumble now.
Yeah. And who ratted? Anyone rat?
Scott got caught, the principal's son.
And he threw everyone under the bus?
I just played innocent. Like, Mom, I don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't involved in any of that.
Uh-huh.
So
she
I
bought
learned,
it?
Yeah, my parents were older. They didn't know.
Okay, Sonny.
I know, Bobby. You would never do that.
So, all right. So you're drinking, you're breaking into houses. When's rock and roll start?
Well, when I start playing it, or not playing it, but I moved to L.A. in 1980, and I had an apartment going to L.A. City College. And the thing that fueled me was my dad's money and the Social Security. As long as I went to college, I had money to live, right?
Uh-huh. So, what, he had a trust?
Yeah, and Social Security. And all these school loans, you could just keep rolling. I went to college from 79 to like 85, I think. I probably have like 6 months of credits. But I started started going to the clubs in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard, and then I started DJing. I told them I was a DJ, and they didn't know. Like,
did you have
I had
records?
A fake ID. I had a crate of records.
Uh-huh.
Play Michael Jackson, little Defunct. Remember that band, Defunct?
Yeah.
And that's how I met Anthony and Flea, because I was like a DJ on Hollywood Boulevard at the Cathay de Grand and at the Club Lingerie.
In 1980, so what bands were you seeing?
I was seeing Dream Syndicate. That was the greatest band.
What's his name, Steve Wynn?
Yeah, or is it Jeff? Carl Pacoda and Dennis Duck.
What
and
was Wynn's first name?
Steve.
It was Steve.
Yeah, they were so great.
Yeah, Days of Wine and Roses is a fucking masterpiece.
God.
And I like Medicine Show, too. The,
me too.
I love
John
that fucking...
John Coltrane on the stereo, baby.
Yeah, and Daddy's Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, I
they
fucking love
so
that.
They were so good.
Yeah.
And that's Salvation Army, and then Black Flag, Circle Jerks, you know.
That was their time.
Yeah, but I wasn't a punk rocker. I never liked...
But that was like second wave, right? So that was... Were the Blasters...
X Blasters. Yeah,
that was
Los Lobos.
Right.
That was the greatest era.
Well, did you...
Talk Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs? You ever heard of them?
No.
Oh, man.
Well, did you gravitate more towards that Americana stuff?
Yeah, always rock and roll. Anything honest and earnest.
But not punk rock, because you're not
like
punk rock.
I didn't like the beating up people.
Yeah,
I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I like Public Image a lot, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
he's like a clown.
Yeah, nowadays.
Yeah. An old clown.
He's got a National Geographic show, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah, he's like a traveler.
They've offered him to interview, and I'm just like, I don't know if I could put up with it. Like, I don't know where he's at with talking, but like, you watch every interview
you know what's
that guy
interesting
does,
about him?
Like,
I know a little bit about him because we had the same manager. He's actually a really interesting, good Renaissance guy, but he puts on the Johnny Rotten thing.
Yeah, it's like, when's
he's
that stop?
He's raised his wife's daughter's children.
Yeah.
Right? As his own.
His wife's daughter's kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure he's a good guy, but I don't have time to try to beat down a wall of Johnny Rotten to get to the good guy.
I've heard you beat things down. I was a little nervous coming here. I was like, what is he going to get at
well,
here?
You're pretty wide open.
I try to be.
We speak the same language. I don't beat too many people down. Sometimes I got to push a little.
because you don't want the bullshit, right? That's what
Yeah, it's just sort of like, you know,
I got a new album out.
Well, there's some of that, but also people who talk a lot publicly have a public narrative, and it's not necessarily that it's a lie or that it's bullshit, but they don't need me to do it. Yeah. You know, so it's just a matter of engaging. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just, some guys just see it as prompting, you know, prompting this. And we all do it. You do it. I do it. But, you know, there has to be a moment where we're just talking.
Yeah, that's what I think that's special about your show. And the idea that you're not going to come in here and just railroad, like, I have a new album, a new movie, a new book.
Yeah.
But how do you keep pure? That's what I really wanted to ask you some questions.
What?
How do you keep pure? Because you must be bribed like a motherfucker to just go along to get along. And I hate all the fucking the nighttime talk shows and that. It's all such bullshit.
Well, I'm pure because they got no boss. And, you know, I get offered a lot of people, but we don't do junk in interviews. Sometimes we'll line shit up in order to get the guest, but we always sort of pretty clear. It's like, well, this is the way we do the show.
Yeah.
So can they do this for an hour? And most of the time it works out, but there's no muscle. You know, obviously occasionally
but, I mean,
you think
ahead.
Must have
been bribed. Like,
by who?
I always think there's a corruptibility to this town once you get on your spot.
Here's the biggest bribe that happens. My old manager, Dave Becky, says, we interview Bob? And I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'll interview Bob.
Becky, my biggest advocate.
He's a great guy.
He is really something.
No, but that's a friend thing. But there's no... The weird thing is I operate in this odd space where, for some reason, that machine respects me and they listen to my show, but they can't buy it. So they, you know, they like having people on it and they like listening to it. And sometimes they have clients, but, you know, I can't get everybody either. Not everybody wants to do this. So there's no real move. There's nothing they can gain from it other than letting me talk to people.
Well, here's my thing is that the whole world is focused on how many Twitter followers somebody has, right?
That's fading, but
it's,
yeah,
it's bullshit.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
Oh, yeah, it's bullshit.
You know,
it was a good run for a little while.
But before that, it was pay-per-clicks. Because I'm a rehab guy, really. Yeah. And I know marketing and how it doesn't mean shit.
Yeah.
Actually, what gets down to it is word of mouth.
Sure.
Right?
And people liking the show. You know, like with a show like this where you're doing audio and you do it consistently, you know, people build a relationship with the show, with me, you know, with the types of conversations we have. And there's nothing to really own. It's a pretty beautiful moment in media right now that if you can find your niche or you can find your area and hold your audience, you can kind of run your own ship. I mean, there's no gates to close. You know what I mean? No one's going to come down and like...
I've just watched every comedian for the last 30 years fight for Johnny Carson's slot, fight for Letterman,
I'm over it.
For all that shit. And all it does is it just gets more and more watered down till it's unwatchable.
It becomes sort of the...
And these are funny people, Mark. You know that.
Well, that's because they're all sort of... It's a context. And they think that's the... They got to honor that context. And no one even gives a fuck about it anymore. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know who watches.
Well, they pay a lot for it.
Yeah, but I mean, even that's starting to slow down a little bit. I mean, you know, some people believe that TV is going to remain vital.
Now I'm going to tell you why Celebrity Rehab exists. You want to know? Because of Jay Leno.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I've been an advocate for drug addicts. I'm a drug addict. I love drug addicts.
Yeah.
I love the whole process of the using and sobriety and how you get there. It's my life.
Yeah.
As important to me as who played bass on Walk on the Wild Side, which was my obsession in my younger life.
Who played bass on Walk on the Wild
Side? Herbie Flowers.
Okay. Do you know that?
Want me to name all five members of Angel? This is what Becky is so impressed by.
Oh, he loves this shit. Yeah.
He loves Angel. You know that band, The White Kiss?
Yeah.
It's Barry Brandt was the drummer. Frank Domino was the singer. Punky Meadows was the guitar player. Remember that? Do you remember Punky Meadows?
Yeah.
Greg Jafria, the only one that went on to have a career, Jafria, the heavy metal band. And the bass player was Mick Jones. The third Mick Jones.
Yeah.
Right? So... As obsessed as I was about music, I became obsessed about addiction and drug addicts and how they get better.
That's where you nerd out.
Yeah, I just became obsessed with it. So I really hold it in high, high regard. Sobriety, how people find it, the storytelling of it. So every night about 8-9 years ago, the punchline on Letterman, on Leno, when everything was these two little girls that were obviously, one was very mentally ill and drug dependent, and one was just a straight up drug addict.
Yeah.
Little girls, 19 and 17 years old, Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears.
Yeah.
And I was watching Leno one night, and the punchline again was, hey, Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just got so fucking pissed. And I went into work the next day, and I said, Drew, you know what? America's so stupid, it doesn't believe anything it doesn't see on television. We need to humanize addicts on television. We need to have a TV show that shows them, you know, how painful the process is, how haunted they are, and what it is that we do. So we should just have cameras here and let a bunch of people get free treatment and have a TV show. And that's what led to Celebrity Rehab. I didn't want it to be
spite.
Celebrities.
Spite.
I wanted the humanness of addicts that we all know.
Well, yeah, because when I watch fucking, when I used to watch Intervention, I'd just be bawling. Because, like,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like, as somebody in recovery, you sort of get that thing, like, I don't know if he's going to make it, that guy.
No, he's probably not going to make it.
You know what I mean? Like, that's just.
How about the girl? Remember the girl, the Huffer girl?
I loved
that episode.
I don't know if I remember.
Put two things of Huffer in her mouth at Walmart and shoot them, and then she'd go, I'm walking on sunshine.
Oh, I don't remember.
She got
her.
Sober.
She did?
Yeah. I just loved her. I remember watching it, and I was single at the time, and I said, I would marry that girl.
Yeah.
Because I'm codependent too, right?
Yeah, I just learned about my codependency pretty recently.
Oh, really?
Ugh, it's a hard one to fucking hit bottom with. So, all right, so you're listening to the music, you're being a DJ. And what happens? You meet Flea and you meet Anthony.
Met Flea and Anthony, and I saw a band called The Replacements. No, but I saw a band called The Replacements.
In that year, in 80?
On the Hootenanny tour in 83.
Oh, shit. That was a mess, huh?
Yeah, it was a train wreck. And I thought, see, because Anthony and Flea already had a band. It was called Tony Flo and the Majestic Mayhems of Funk or something. Masters of Mayhem or
something. So Flea always liked that.
Yeah, he was a genius. He's been a genius since the day he was born with music. So they had this thing where Anthony rapped and a band called What Is This, which was Flea, Hillel, and Jack Irons, played behind Anthony rapping.
Yeah.
And they were all like cool, great musicians, and Anthony super handsome and cool.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, well, people like me don't play music. But then when I saw The Replacements, I was like, hey, people like me play music.
Yeah.
Right.
And they played more of the kind of music you like.
Yeah. And so that was very inspiring. I went home that night and I called a bunch of friends. I said, well, I want to form a band. And slowly, you know, Thelonious Monster was born out of seeing The Replacements.
And when did the dope start?
I was scared of dope. I did it one time with Top Jimmy, and then I was scared of it.
You shot it?
Yeah. First time. I was like 1980.
Yeah.
And I was just scared of it, and I stayed clear of it, and then Anthony and Flea and I were really into coke.
Yeah.
Right? And
sure.
We didn't come down.
Yeah.
We came down 2 to 3 days later,
right.
And we'd eat watermelon.
Yeah.
Because I thought watermelon is like saline solution.
Yeah.
It'll purify you.
The weird hangover cures.
Watermelon.
Yeah, sure.
And sleeping.
Yeah.
And listening to Graham Parsons' Grievous Angel. That was our process.
That's a hard come down a little
we'd
bit.
We'd play cribbage.
Nice.
Me and Anthony play cribbage.
Yeah.
We'd eat watermelon, listen to Graham Parsons. That's how we came down.
Hey, you guys have been up for a few days. Make note of that system and then get to a meeting.
And then, you know, slowly about 85, 86 is where dope starts coming. I had a girlfriend that did dope,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, I always steered clear of it.
And that was around the first album?
Yeah, when our first album came out is when I had just started doing it. In 85, we made it. And so, you know, and it was just like a weekend, you know, warrior type thing. I didn't do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly drinking was my primary problem, always has been, really.
And the first record, like, unlike which was the first one?
Baby, You're Bumming My Life Out in a Supreme Fashion.
And yeah, so that record was a little all over the place stylistically, right?
Yeah, we were trying to be Lounge Lizards, but we weren't good enough. So it came out this hybrid hodgepodge of blues and
little funk.
Yeah, I don't know what. And so slowly we, you know, because that wreck, because of our live show was pretty, you know, it was pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of obsessed with Darby Crash. So,
oh, you were?
The whole thing, yeah.
But you didn't like punk, but you were obsessed with him.
I liked him.
Yeah.
I liked his lyrics.
Were you able to see him?
No, I saw the Darby Crash band, but not the Germs.
Like right before he died?
Yeah, right before he died, a couple months before.
Yeah. So and, you liked his performance chops?
Yeah, I just liked his whole, you know,
loose,
yeah,
floppy,
yeah,
kind of spontaneously aggressive.
Like Jim Morrison. It was more like Jim Morrison than what is like anything else.
Well, he's definitely in his own time zone.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely, yeah, and he couldn't sing and he couldn't really keep time.
But you can sing?
I learned how to sing. You know, I sang in choir in Catholic school.
And you listened to David Bowie.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
That's all you need. Elvis Costello. People ask me all the time, how do you really learn how to sing? And I say, get like the first four Elvis Costello records and play them in your car and sing along. And eventually you'll know how it works.
Imperial Bedroom.
Imperial Bedroom.
Oh, boy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, he's a hell of a singer. So then you do, like, I guess most people know you for Beautiful Mess primarily. Yeah. That was the big record.
Tom Waits song on there.
Is that on that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that. But how'd you know Waits? Because that's Waits in, what is that? And that's 92, so where's Waits at in his journey?
He's about to make Bone Machine, because he called me. I became acquaintance with him, or friends with, I don't know why. I saw him at Keith Richards' show.
So it's right after Heart Attack and Vine, when everything breaks apart?
No, he had made Rain Dogs.
Oh, he did Rain Dogs, yeah. Okay.
And so, and he had done Frank's Wild Years.
Right.
And then he was like trying to reinvent it. You know, that's when it really got weird.
Right.
If you thought Rain Dogs was weird and Swordfish Trombone was weird,
yeah.
Wait till you hear Bone Machine. So he calls me one day, and I pick up a landline, and I go, hello? And he goes, Bone Machine. And I was like, Tom? And he goes, Bone Machine. And I was like, what's going on? And he goes, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? And I was like, because you always want to answer right for Tom Waits.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know, like a car made out of bones? And he goes, oh, shit. And then Kathleen was there, his wife, and she said, what did he say? And I heard her say that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I knew I said the wrong answer.
What?
He thinks a bone machine is a human body. It's a bone machine.
Right.
But, you know, it's tried to answer it right.
It was like his version of Meat Puppet.
I got the sense that he wanted to call the album Bone Machine,
yeah.
And she did not.
That's funny. Let's call Bob.
We're calling, you know, a cross section of their acquaintances to see what the reaction was.
I guess they got enough of the percentage for Kathleen to lose that one.
He was over at my house here in Mount Washington one time, and I had bought that record that he got ripped off by so bad by that company. You know, he got ripped off really bad.
Which
early
record?
On in his career. And Island released, or not Island, Asylum released some greatest hits thing.
Yeah.
And I had just bought it, and it was in my house. And he came in, and he goes, what's this? And I said, it's got Martha on it and everything. And he opened my front door and threw it out the front door. So he came into my life for like a year and a half, 2 years, and then he just disappeared to Roseville.
So no
but
more?
I went up there and recorded with him.
Recently?
No, just
for that song?
That song, yeah.
Are you guys still friends?
Yeah, I mean, I see him. He's very reclusive.
I know. I'd love to talk to him, but
he won't come out much.
Well, I don't know. I don't even know how to get in. You know, he does
There's
like
one guy, I know. He doesn't have a manager. He doesn't
He does like one interview a year.
You got to go up there. Maybe
I'll
take
go up there.
Take this shit up there.
I take shit up there. I got a rig.
He meets you at a truck stop.
I travel
I
with this.
There you go.
I was a huge Waits fan, man.
He's the best.
In high school, that's another guy I didn't mention. In that box of records I told you about was Nighthawks at the Diner.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, holy fuck, what is this?
Big Joe and Phantom.
Yeah, and I used to wear that hat like he had on the cover. I'd wear shirts like his. I dressed like Waits. Probably my sophomore year of high school.
There you go, man.
Yeah, he was my guy for a while. I just saw, how can he be this fucking funny and this fucking cool and playing this old style music?
It was
fucking amazing.
It was amazing. So I was peeing next to him at the Keith Richards show at the Palladium, and I looked over and I was kind of drunk, and I said, oh my God, Tom Waits. And he goes, oh my God, Bob Forrest. And I go, how the fuck do you know who I am? And I almost peed on him, and I was like, I almost fainted. And he goes, I go see Thelonious all the time. And then we were in the bathroom there, and I was like, what? I would hear that if you were at our show.
Right.
And he goes, let me tell you something. I was at a show with other a couple of months ago, and you and the drummer just went at it physically. Physical. You decked him, and he knocked you over, and then you just walked back to your places and continued on. Is that real hostility, or is that some sort of stage thing? And I said, no, I fucking hate him. And he goes, that's what I thought.
And that's when you met Tom Waits?
Yeah, that's when it was so cool, like, have him in my life. He called me one time, he said, you want to go to the Wiltern and see this bald chick? And I was like, what? It was Sinead O'Connor.
All All right, so you're doing dope. Your first record's out. You're finding your groove, because by the time Beautiful Mess comes out, you definitely have a style. It's not punk rock. It's sort of like pop Americana, but good, right?
Trying.
Yeah. So how when did you get strung out bad?
Bad was a little before Beautiful Mess. I got this solo deal with RCA.
Yeah.
And they gave me, back in the day, they used to give you a lot of money when they thought you could be a star.
Even the sweating guy. Let's give the sweating guy a couple $100,000.
Crazy.
The guy with no pupils. Let's give him some money.
I literally went from, like, you know, living in this one bedroom house on Fountain to, like, living in the Hollywood Hills and doing whatever the fuck I wanted. And it was crazy.
On a record
That's
deal.
Bad. Yeah. That's a bad deal.
And that was the deal for Beautiful Mess?
No. It was for the solo deal that never came out. I made the most horrible record ever made.
Do you have the tapes?
Yes, I do.
How are they?
My mom has them. My sister mom.
Yeah.
I sometimes listen to them when I'm in Oklahoma.
Just, that's where she is now?
Yeah, she's in the witness protection program. That's a whole nother story.
Really?
Yeah. She went there. She married a coke dealer, and then he turns evidence against the Bonanno family, and they had to get out. And...
Is she still married to him?
No, they divorced, but she stayed out there. She likes it out there.
She's got to stay in the program?
Huh?
She's got to stay in the witness protection program?
No. It was just to get away and lay low.
Yeah.
But that's why she went out there 20 years ago.
Oh,
and
my
And she stays out there. She was born in L.A.
What happened to the dude? Did they hit him?
He's still around, Terry. Yeah. He's a good guy. He's married to somebody else, has a bunch of kids.
But so the curse is off him, though?
Curse is off him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy shit. All right, so you make a shitty solo album, you're all fucked up on heroin, and you're living up in
That's
the hills.
When I go to my first rehab, because the girl I was dating's dad was sober. And he was like...
What's that, 87?
88.
Yeah.
87, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I went to Hazelden. I remember they did this kind of intervention on me, but I knew it was coming, because I'd been working on an album for a year, and I had nothing. And so... you know, I went to this restaurant,
that's
Citrus,
why,
on
that's when I went to my first rehab.
I went to Hazelden.
No, I didn't.
But they said they wanted me to go to this one in L.A. And I said, I'm not going to one in L.A. I'll just leave. I know myself. And I said, listen, I read in the National Enquirer that Elizabeth Taylor went to some rehab in Minnesota. I want to go to that one. That's how I chose my first rehab, the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
Because I was so much like Liz.
Sure. Maybe you could hang out. Maybe she'd come up there.
So, but that was a great experience. That's when rehab really worked.
Right.
I knew when I walked out of Hazelden 33 days later, I knew what the problem was. I knew that I had it.
Yep.
I knew it was a disease.
Yeah.
I knew what to do about it. I just didn't want to do anything about it.
How long did you stay sober?
About 8 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what pulled you back?
I'm an atheist, so it was kind of hard. I'd go to meetings every day.
But you got hung up on it.
Yeah, I got hung up on the God thing.
Yeah, that's so much the mental ticket out for, like, guys who really, like, who get it. But then
I get it.
Yeah.
And so nowadays, I just, you know, regardless of what people believe, we're all doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So just keep doing the same thing. I have a two-step program, if you'd like to join it, Mark.
Sure, what is it?
Be cool and don't use. Yeah. Be cool is a big tent thing.
Yes.
There's a lot of things.
Try
in the
to
be
hit
cool.
a meeting occasionally.
That's being cool.
Yeah,
helping out, driving people to meetings to pick them up at rehab.
The God thing, like, there's some guy said something in a meeting once that just sort of works for me. Is that, like, God doesn't wake up and think he's you. All right.
That's a good one.
That's enough.
Yeah, I like that one.
You haven't heard that one. How often do you hear one you haven't heard after how long you got sober now?
19 years.
Holy fuck. All right, so you get sober the first time, but you were able to, you were in and out?
I knew that it was the solution.
Yeah.
I just wasn't, you know, I met a great counselor. Her name was Gloria Scott. Years later in a rehab, and I said, why is it so hard for me just to catch on to these simple shit? And she goes, I have a theory. To the degree of your arrogance will be the degree of your suffering.
Pride. Yeah.
So I was a pretty arrogant, frightened
child.
That's
pretty good. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Pride's a fucking bitch.
I was scared.
Yeah.
Is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought sobriety was going to be boring. You know, that's what a lot of young people think these days.
It turns out it's fucking insane.
It's really hard to go through a month, a year.
If you think in terms of what using is.
Yeah.
You know, like a guy, I talked to a guy. It was interesting. It was an interesting moment. I've tried to explain it a couple of times, but it doesn't quite resonate. I know a guy's on medicine. and he's on, you know, like bipolar medication. They gave him some Klonopins to self-medicate when shit got out of hand in case the Lamictal wasn't working.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I basically the prescription was, is like, you know, when you need to, you know, feel better, you know, take one of these if you're going, you know, either way.
I need to feel better all the time.
That's what he said. He said, you take one. It's like, of course this feels better.
Okay. It feels better.
It's always going to feel better.
Always.
Yeah.
Here's my thing is, when Lenny Bruce was doing dope, there was probably 0.1% of the population was doing dope.
Yeah.
Right? Nowadays, 1/3 of the population is doing dope.
Something.
You know, it's not outlaw. It's
right.
not outside the norm. It's mainstream.
Right.
Your mom and your grandma are on
right.
drugs.
Right.
Addictive, deadly, destructive drugs.
Yeah.
They may be coming from Walgreens
right.
instead of Chewy.
Yeah.
But they're the same thing.
So did when you roadied first for the Chili Peppers?
Yeah, yeah.
And they were just your buddies and you just hang out?
I started as the manager, then I became the road manager, then I became the roadie, then I was fired completely. by my best friends.
Yeah. And you guys are all still friends?
Yeah, yeah. Talk to them.
And everybody's
all the time.
Sober.
Yeah.
That's fucking
it's weird, right?
It's amazing.
And the funny thing is we used to talk about it a lot, talk about it less now, and gone round and round about it, whether it helps or hinders.
Yeah.
One of the things I think was 16 and 19, I think that discourages. I don't think
discourages
it
discourages what?
People to think they could be sober and live a happy, fun life, not on drugs.
Yeah.
You know, lots been made about my sobriety. It's just like the first 7-8 years felt so purposeful and I felt so connected to new people and whatever. Mm-hmm. And as the years have rolled on, I just feel, I try to be there and present with them, but it's a big distance.
I don't know, like lately, I guess we can just talk freely about it. It's like, I get to a point where I get pretty dry and I can see it and I can feel it. No matter how many good things are going on, like there's that weird thing, like I just become relatively successful in the last few years and I'm still uncomfortable and I still get angry and I still have very little patience. So my gratitude situation is not in good place. And then I get that weird, dry, aggravated, why don't I have something? And then, like, I'll go to a meeting and I'll talk to a new guy. Like, I just started talking to a new guy and I'm like, holy shit, I know how this works. And it feels pretty good to tell someone else, you know, how I did it or you know, to be helpful.
To be present with them.
Yeah,
that's what I like. When somebody's really, when I really connect with somebody.
Yeah.
And it's a couple of years process, really.
Yeah.
Where you really, like, become this closeness.
Right.
You know, it's not every sponsee, but it's once in a while, it's pretty magical. And I always say there's three states of being in relation to to AA,
yeah.
right? You're entering into it.
Yeah.
You're fully engaged in it or you're leaving it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
What's great about it is if a new person asks somebody who's leaving and they really connect, they both immediately become fully engaged in it.
Yeah.
That to me is the thing that saved me time and time again.
Then that lays the foundation. Here's the weird thing is that I always tell these guys, it's like, just fucking make it your own. Don't get hung up on who's doing it right or whether you're doing it right or which guy's like shoving what down your throat and how to do it and when to do it.
Oh, you're just speaking my language, buddy.
Because I was always the aggravated guy. At every year, at every juncture, to this day, I'm not comfortable. I'm not, you know, I'm grateful to be sober and I don't want to live any other way. And I, you know, the woman who brought me in used to say this thing where she'd be like, the only step you have to work perfectly is the first one. And I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe meetings will keep you sober. But I also know that, like, I can't play this thing by the rules. I got, you know, I understand how to make these steps my own and also how to integrate them into my life so I can own them. You got to own that shit.
Do you want to get really technical about it?
Uh-huh.
There's a sentence in the book that says, this is a design for living, a bridge back to the real world.
Yeah.
That suggests that AA is not the real world, that we're supposed to go out and practice this shit with the people down the street here. And with, you know, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. But
that's like the old Buddhist saying, easy to be spiritual on a mountaintop, hard down in the village.
Right, right, right.
That's where...
And also I get very defensive when these articles start coming out about why AA is a cult or why it's like, no,
who
it's
cares?
Not. But no one's making any money.
It's a
Don't
benign
go.
Cult.
Yeah,
it is like, a cult. It's a benign cult. Nobody's in charge of it. Doesn't make any money.
I had a guy say this. Yeah, exactly. But the thing is like, don't fucking tear it down if you offer nothing in return. Don't go. You know, if you don't have the bug and it's not for you, go, well, then fuck off.
Yeah, I think that AA used to be much more welcoming of other things. A lot of my friends have gotten sober lots of different ways. Having a
stay
family.
Sober. Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. Like, they're those gifted people that just are like, no, no, no.
One of my friends I
it.
Worked with went back to the Catholic Church and became like a devout Catholic, and he's a concierge or something, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
It's not a priest, but it's something.
Yeah.
And like, he's all into that. Like, fine. He doesn't shoot dope anymore. Good for him. You know.
Some guy used to tell this story about how he told his sponsor early in sobriety. It's like, I don't want to fucking get brainwashed. And his sponsor said, your brain needs washing.
Gloria Scott said that to me. Same woman that said, to the degree of your arrogance. There used to be, that's the other thing. There used to be champions of storytelling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I one time drank a 6-pack of beer in AA meeting to see what happened. You know what happened? Nothing.
No, they're just like, no. Nobody said anything.
Then I'm walking out as a third and gardener at the old original one. I'm walking out. About 100 people said, keep coming back, Bob.
You thought you'd start
some shit. I wanted to get thrown out so bad.
They absorb everything. And the showboats, you know, who have a new way or a different way. There was a while there in New York and San Francisco where there was this subgroup coming around called the Transmitters, and they would sit there and they would inventory constantly. It was like an inventory.
Are you kidding?
No,
exhausting.
Yeah, every 5 minutes
they became tired.
Every 5 minutes they were inventorying, and they thought they were going to do a branch off group. And people were kind of panicky at first, and it's just like, it's like democracy in a way. It's like, they'll go away, just
come and go.
Yeah, they'll filter out. But okay, so when did you get sober for real, and how did Beautiful Mess? What was the thing that leveled your career in the
band?
Well,
the band ended. They got tired of me.
But did your record company fuck you?
No. It was all good. We were actually doing the best we had done when we kind of broke up. It was in Europe, and I had ruined this big tour, and
because you were fucked up.
Yeah, really fucked up.
Was that where there's stuff on YouTube?
Yeah. Well, that's one show, but it was just one time I didn't even go to our show. I went and saw Guns N' Roses at another place, and I forgot that we were playing.
Would you shoot up right before you went on?
No, I mostly smoked crack. I was always pretty high from heroin, so I needed something to pick me up.
Yeah.
And I'd play, and then I'd drink while I played, and then I'd do dope when I got back to the hotel.
Oh, yeah, to come down from everything?
Just a constant self-medicating.
But it's interesting, because I have to assume that I watch some of this stuff, and it seems to me that you must have informed Cobain a little bit, just singing stylistically, it felt that. Does anyone say that?
Yeah, but, you know, I feel sad because we were a generation that was very positive about celebrating, you know, debauchery.
Right.
And then I think the casualties came in that next generation, which were Kurt and Shannon Hoon and Brad Noel from Sublime. I think they looked up to us. They were like five or seven years younger than us. And we were already bands that had records.
Right.
And when I say we, I'm looking at Anthony, Perry, me.
Yeah.
We were pretty obviously.
How's Perry doing?
Drug addicts. He's great. He's like Mr. Husband.
Oh, yeah?
You know, we see him with his wife and kids. Like, it's really weird. He and I were at the, what was it called? The Tony Hawk Foundation luncheon the other day with our kids, and like, it's just so weird.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you're lucky. You got
lucked
older.
Out.
You had kids late, right?
Yeah. Well, I have a 5-year-old and a 28-year-old.
Where'd the 28-year-old come from?
From, you know, that era.
Oh, yeah?
Mid-80s.
From a woman's vagina?
Yeah, that's how it happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I tried to be a dad and wasn't very good at it. And then when I got sober, he was 8 and he moved in with me. And we got a good relationship. Yeah, he lives in Baltimore.
Yeah?
He wanted to get out of L.A.
Oh, that's smart.
It was weird. He's a musician, and all of us tried to help him, and he didn't want our help.
Is he still? Still a musician?
Oh, yeah. He makes a lot of records. Kids nowadays, they make like records every 6 months.
What's his band? What's he?
It's called The Terrors.
Uh-huh.
And, well, he doesn't like you to say The, because here's an interesting thing. So we always say The Terrors.
Yeah.
But it's just Terrors.
Uh-huh.
So Anthony talks about him in Rolling Stone magazine. I say, do you see Anthony talked about you in Rolling Stone? He's like, I don't know who he was talking about. He was talking about The Terrors. Uh-huh. I don't know who that is. I was like, you are such a prick.
Tell your friend to get it right, Dad. So after a Beautiful Mess and everything, you did a couple solo albums and mostly focused on sobriety? Was that the life?
I just started working. Like I made the Bicycle Thief record and I toured that, and it was just kind of ran its course. And then I thought, you know, I'm like 40 years old. What the fuck am I going to do with? Hopefully I'll live 30 more years.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of roadmaps of musicians. Like, what do you do? Do you go back
to school? Were you bitter?
No, no, I was pretty content. Uh-huh. You know, The Bicycle Thief did pretty well. And so uh-huh. I was financially sound, and I was just like wondering what the fuck am I going to do? Am I just going to go to Tropical and wear rock and roll t-shirts and like be 50 years old?
Be the legendary and sober
so,
guy?
Yeah. And so Anthony said, why don't you go down and volunteer at MAP? And so that's what I did, and that's how I got into the racket. You know, there was this thing called Musicians Assistance Program, mm-hmm. and it was just the greatest thing. Paid for hundreds and thousands of musicians to go to treatment, and mm-hmm. it was this brother and sisterhood, and it just was a magnificent thing. It became Music Cares, which is kind of a corporate kind of thing.
And your relationship with Drew started how?
I took some of my clients. I started working at this place, first fundraising and then running groups, and I really liked it. And I went, they needed extras for this Bill Nye the Science Guy show about addiction, and Drew was the host of it, and I had known him from the 80s being on the radio.
Yeah.
And he kept looking at me, and then afterwards he said, what's your name? And I said, Bob, it's Bob Forrest, dude, from Thelonious Monster. And he's like, I heard that you died. And I go, well, I certainly did not. And he said, you need to come and work with me. So then about a year later, when MAP dissolved into Music Cares, yeah. I went and worked with him.
And history is made.
Well, you know, I learned a lot from that. I mean, he helped me grow up a lot.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for him and this other doctor, Dr. Blum, they gave me a dictionary.
Yeah.
And said there are other words in the English language than fuck.
Uh-huh.
And so they challenged me, you know, and they mentored me, and I kind of...
But you got out without the HEP?
I got the HEP.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I've been in remission or like low yeah. viral count, so I don't qualify for the medicine.
Oh.
Yeah.
But because I got a medicine that gets
yeah,
that
$1,000 a pill if you want it cash. You got to get it covered by your insurance. Yeah. Now I heard Blue Cross PPO doesn't have the same criteria as mine.
Yeah.
So I might switch when the next Obamacare thing comes around.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Just in case.
But I'll switch to Blue Cross PPO and they'll say, we don't pay for that anymore if you're healthy and whatever.
Right. So you've been all right with it.
I've been all right. When I go in to get sonograms or viral counts, they just like... They can't believe how low it is.
Huh.
You know, I've been sober a long time. I try to eat right. I don't smoke.
Yeah.
You know, but eventually it'll catch up with you.
Yeah.
You know, I just couldn't do the interferon. I was so...
Yeah, it knocks a lot of guys out.
Well, I knocked my friend Harold out, and then it didn't cure him. And I thought, fuck, you got 6 months of that shit, and then it doesn't work?
Yeah.
Now this new drug is so magical, but it costs so much.
Right. Well, maybe eventually it'll lower a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, it's got to.
So... Do you have your own rehab center?
Yeah, I got this place out in Malibu called Acadia. It's all insurance driven, but I used to own it and I kind of sold it to my partners. I'm trying to play music.
Well, yeah, well, this new record, it's good. Yeah. You want to play some?
Yeah, I'll play. All right.
Okay. What are you going to play?
That's the album that I figured out. I was going to play two songs. I'd play the first song and the last song.
What about the Serial song? Do you play that?
Oh, you want to play that? Some teeth I can't chew, my favorite cereal with it.
that wears got me 35 years old now. Wash dishes in a restaurant. Well, my friend Robert, well, he can't stop, and his teeth are falling out. He's living at his mom's and it's no fun. I guess it's lucky I'm alive. They say it's lucky I'm alive, 'cause I should be dead. Well, I have been dead, but I'm not no more. And what did it get me? Just some teeth I can't chew, my favorite cereal with. Yeah, winners have gotten me 35 years old now. Washed just in a restaurant.
That one.
That'll work.
Yeah, sounds great.
Oh, thanks. That was fun.
What other one do you do?
I've been trying to do them all. The one I really like is, you know, people always ask you, don't they ask you, like, what have you learned from being sober all this time?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All this, what's the wisdom? I was like, fuck, I'm just barely getting through the day today. Don't have any real, don't use, be cool.
Well, you got a song?
Yeah, I wrote it, so it's like when I was in my best state of, like, thinking I knew something. There'll be peace in the valley when there's peace in my heart. But the road gets so winding that you just get lost. My friends, let me tell you, as dumb as it sounds, well, kindness is everything, and love is all there is. Well, kindness is everything. The baby gets born. Kindness is everything, and love is all there is. Well, kindness is everything, and love is all there is.
That sounded great, man.
Crackly, but it's all right.
It's all right. What do you want to do? You good?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. It was great to see you. I'm glad you're doing well.
Yeah.
And I love the record.
Glad to be here.
Did we cover it all?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You got it. You know, so podcasts, right? They say, well, yeah, that was good. And then we'll tighten it up. Where does tightening it up come from? It's got to be a sexual term.
Well, it used to mean, I think, getting tight meant getting high
Oh,
at some point. But tighten it up means, you know, just
Because yeah. I think Archie Bell and the Drells do the tighten up, y'all.
I guess it's been used a lot of different ways, but I think it just means we'll tighten it up. All right, man.
Tighten it up.
I hope that was exciting and interesting and inspiring. And again, don't be afraid to ask for help. There's help out there. Save your life if it needs to be saved, and have the will to at least pick up a phone or go get some help if you need help for whatever it is. All right, there's no shame in it. Merry Christmas. I love you all. Most of you. Some of you I don't. Some of you I tolerate. But that's, you know, that's mature. Tolerance is a mature and decent thing to do. Now, I love you all right now. It's fading, though. No, I'll stick in it. I'll stay in it. Happy holidays. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.